So Alejandro, you've had a career in politics and then a financier. And then, of course, you leveraged all that into racing. Interesting career. So based on your experience, do you think that politicians or financiers would make better race car drivers?
I think politicians would make for sure better race car drivers than financiers.
Why is that?
I think politicians have a more ability to manage large groups like your racing team, to bring people together to achieve a goal. I think they do things more long-term. I think they're less worried about the pressure of the short-term. So I think politicians would make a better race drivers.
So if you're headed into a turn and you're going to outbreak, you think they'd be better doing that outbreaking maneuver than the financier?
Definitely, yeah. The politicians, they worry less about the consequences.
All right. Arguably, one of the biggest issues of our time is climate change, and we have all started to feel the effects caused by a warming planet. The concept of sustainability, finding long-term, renewable alternatives to environmentally adverse practices, is becoming a lead talking point in most spaces, including the world of motorsports. So the face of racing is changing, for racing has to maintain its technological leadership, and more importantly, it has to stay relevant, especially when it comes to sustainability. Today, on our podcast, we have the pioneer of electric car racing, on-road, off-road, and soon even on the water, Alejandro Agag, the CEO of Formula E Holdings. He started off in politics, he was a financier, and he's now taken all that background and moved into racing, where he's utilizing racing to help build a more sustainable future for all of us. He founded the Formula E Racing Series in 2012, and fast forward to today, Formula E is widely successful and has led to the inspiration of Extreme E, Extreme H, and the E1 Boat Racing Series. Welcome to the Future Car Podcast. I'm your host, Ed Bernard, the VP of Automotive Strategy at Siemens Digital Industries Software. And today, Alejandro and I are talking about climate change, sustainability, and the role of motorsports based on electric and hydrogen-powered vehicles, and the role they will play in all this. In part one, Alejandro breaks down the different racing series, what he hopes each will achieve when it comes to sustainability, and we discuss his motivations behind starting the first series, Formula E, in 2012, and how it's grown and developed since then. We also talk about the technology involved in developing these electric vehicles, the fan involvement, Mario Karts, what the future looks like for electric vehicles, and how all of this started as notes on a napkin from a dinner in a Paris restaurant. Alejandro, welcome to the Future Car Podcast.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be with you.
I wanted to talk to you about Formula E and how it really got started back in 2012. An interesting statistic from that year is that 120,000 electric cars were sold globally. In 2021, 120,000 electric cars were sold globally in just a week. So we've gone from 120,000 cars in a year to 120,000 in a week. What was your motivation back in 2012? To get into electric car racing when people barely even noticed EVs were around?
I think at that time, 10 years ago, my motivation was a double motivation. I had two main kind of drivers. One was obviously sustainability. One was to try to make racing more sustainable, to basically do something good with my own activity, because I was a racer. I love racing, but I felt, and here is where the second motivation comes, that we were losing the relevance. We were losing really the connection with where things were going, and things were going to a more sustainable future. The second motivation is financial, is business. I saw that this could be a great business opportunity. I saw that combining racing with sustainability could be a great place to sell a sponsorship, could be a great place to offer a new race to venues around the world. All in all, could be a great business opportunity. So one motivation, sustainability, the other one, business.
When you start a business, sometimes at first, it's not profitable,
but you had to have the vision that it's going to be maybe a year out or several years out. How long did it take for Formula E to truly be a good business? Was it a good business right away, or did it take 2-3 years?
It took about 5 years. In the beginning, it was a very loss-making, heavily loss-making business. But we always were convinced that in the medium term, if we managed to survive, this was going to be a great business. It took longer than we thought. Costs were higher than we thought. Revenues took longer than we thought. So, of course, there was a gap, and we had to raise capital again and again. But luckily, we were able to find investors that were always willing to support this kind of vision, this kind of project. I think mainly because of the sustainability angle of the project and the technology angle of the project, also about electric cars. So we were able to raise capital and go through those tough moments. And today it's a very profitable business.
So the sustainability angle, obviously key to Formula E. So motorsports, in some ways, not electric racing, but has become, from a sustainability standpoint, internal combustion engines making the air dirty. But you sort of turned it around. And now you're taking this idea of sustainability, but you're getting it out there through the power of motorsports and making it exciting. What is the role of motorsports here in taking something like sustainability and making it exciting? How does that actually work?
I think the role of motorsport can be really important. And you said it right. Sustainability sometimes is perceived as not fun and as not that attractive. It's a boring topic, which is the contrary. It's an incredibly important topic. We need to make it fun. Motorsport has the power to bring sustainability to a much wider audience, people who necessarily don't want to watch a documentary, but they want to watch a race. If you take this race like we do in Formula E to cities and we showcase electric cars, or you take it with Extreme E to most remote corners of the planet where climate change is actually having a huge impact, that is using motorsport as a tool for the climate action cause.
So you go to all these cities all over the world, and you mentioned you're getting a new type of fan. Can you give me an example of how the fan base might be a little bit different based on the people you've met in the different cities where you've raced from the sustainability standpoint?
Well, if you want to hear the extreme example, we took a race to Greenland. I mean, nothing had ever happened in Greenland in terms of sports, let alone a race with cars and infrastructure. And we took our ship there and so on and so on. There were 144 people living in the town where we had near where we had the race. So all 144 came to the race. So there you go, 144 new Inuit fans for a electric motorsport. That would be the extreme, because of course we're going to places that are really remote. But it's a different fan base. Well, it's different and similar, because the younger generation that likes motorsport enjoys electric motorsport, and they like to see a motorsport that has a cause behind, a purpose. But also you have a lot of older, like me, fan of motorsports that we still like to see these races. I mean, let's not forget, some of the best drivers in the world of motorsport in general are racing in these races.
And it's also good to feel that motorsports is relevant. That's got to be a piece of it.
Yeah, that's the key, the relevance and the connection to the real life. 10 years ago, when we started this, 120,000 electric cars were sold in the world in the year. Now, 120 cars were sold in the world last week. So the acceleration of the sale of electric cars has been huge. And of course, part of that, maybe a very small part, it's thanks to a world championship of electric cars existing and people having seen it. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of millions have been exposed to Formula E races. Also, the improvement in technology of these cars, some of it comes from Formula E. So we had a role in that. So definitely it has an impact. The connection between the real life and motorsport is what makes it relevant.
Did you drive an electric car to work today?
Well, I don't drive myself, but I did came in a car that it was hybrid.
Well, there you go. So you got that little piece of electric in.
Absolutely. And I have no bike. My wife, she went fully electric to her office this morning. No, we drive electric at home.
In your garage at home, is it full of electric cars? Do you have any internal combustion engine cars in there?
My garage is very interesting because I have an i3, so I have a fully electric car. Then I have the first winner of the Formula E race in Beijing is in my garage. That's a race car that is full electric. I don't really drive it to the office, but it's a Formula car. And then I have a small Cinquecento from 1964 that is combustion, but we're going to transform it to electric.
It's been said that this whole idea started off on a napkin that you were sketching when you were sitting down with Jean Todt. So you're sitting there having dinner. Hey, let's do an electric car racing series. What do you think, Jean Todt? Is that how it went?
That's almost how it went. So Jean had been elected president of the FIA, of the Federation of Motorsport. From my time in politics, one of my colleagues was Antonio Tajani, who is an Italian politician who at the time was vice president of the European Commission, in charge of the industry portfolio, which had the motor industry within the industry portfolio. So Jean was keen to meet with him to understand where the commission was going in the general direction of the industry, of the motor industry. I organized a dinner for the three of us in a small restaurant in Paris called Stresa. And yeah, I had this napkin and then we were talking and Antonio kept going on and on about how the commission was going to push electrification, the targets for CO2 emissions for cars, and so on and so forth. And Jean said, we should do an electric car championship. And I said, I'll organize that. And I was writing on this napkin. And the napkin today is on a frame above that table in that restaurant in Paris.
Oh, wow. I was going to ask you if you kept it. So you still go back there and have a meal every now and then?
Well, I go a lot to the restaurant. Yeah, I go a lot to the restaurant. It's run by five brothers. Italian brothers is great. It's a great place. Best pasta in Paris.
All right. What was the name of the restaurant again? So everybody could go there and see the napkin.
It's called the Stresa. Like stress, but with an A at the end. Stresa.
Stresa. Okay. Via Stresa in Paris. World's most famous napkin, probably in a frame. So yeah, Formula E, Extreme E, Extreme H is coming. E1 on the water. Tell us about the different series, how they complement each other, how they're the same, how they're different, the goals of each. Tell us a little bit about all these series that you've created or in creating here.
Each series has a different role and a different kind of soul, but they're all, of course, interconnected. ABB Formula E Championship, we call it the ABB Formula Championship. Now we have a great partnership with ABB. It's really the expression of formula cars racing in cities, the expression of electric race cars inside the cities. And the message is electric cars are ready for mobility in the cities today, now. And we can showcase and bring that closer to the fans in the heart of the cities. So that's Formula E. Extreme E was, let's take these cars, let's take electric cars, like another version, rally to showcase that these cars can work in every environment. And at the same time, to take them to places that have been damaged by climate change or have suffered the impact of climate change, and to showcase that and to talk about that and to embed that message into our broadcasting. And that's Extreme E. Extreme H comes almost like a sequel of Extreme E to create a platform for hydrogen. Hydrogen is a new technology. Until now, electric cars have been working with batteries mainly. But there is also this other technology, hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells in this case, where we can use a hydrogen fuel cell to charge a battery that then powers the electric motor. So effectively, we're talking about an electric car that basically stores the energy in a different way. You can store the energy on a battery or you can store the energy on hydrogen. Hydrogen is really a storage mechanism, not really an energy source. That's the Extreme H. And we want to give this platform to this technology that is becoming more and more important. And, you know, especially green hydrogen can play a very important role in decarbonizing mobility, particularly ships, maybe larger vehicles. But we want to give a platform to that technology. And then E1 is basically taking all this electrification and mobility revolution to the water. And the water is going to be the next frontier for decarbonization. I think many, many water areas, lakes, rivers are going to become electric only, to become cleaner. There's a lot of pollution that comes from the diesel engines on these boats. So we're going to have to make a championship. We are going to make a championship to promote electric boats, battery electric boats for now. Probably hydrogen will play a big role in the future. Also develop the technology for these boats that then can make them ready for mass adoption.
I think I see an interesting pattern here. So a Formula E, let's take this electric drive technology, battery technology, supply it to racing. Let's show this that it can be done technologically. You did that. Now you say, hey, let's take what we've learned technologically and let's use it to bring attention to all these different places challenged by climate change. Then, hey, it's not just battery electric vehicles, also hydrogen. So technology comes in again. Now you take all of that and you apply it to water to draw attention to what's happening. So it's sort of a back and forth, it seems like the technology and bringing attention to sustainability really playing off each other, not within a series, but between all the series as it grows.
It is. And the beautiful thing is that you have the technology, but the technology doesn't change so much from a car to a boat. So we can take a lot of the lessons we learned developing technology for race cars and apply them to boats. And actually, the engineers that created the powertrains of Generation 2 Formula E are working on the E1 boats and the Siever company to create the E1 electric boat. So there is definitely a technology transfer from land to water in this case. And maybe probably there will be technology transfer on the opposite direction from the water to land, depending on what we can develop in the water.
Do the engineers from these different series, do they communicate? with each other? Some participate in multiple series, correct?
Some of them are the same. So basically, because the races don't clash, some go from series to series, and the lessons you learn on one series, you can apply on the other one. So this kind of a big technology campus traveling around the world, basically. It's like a traveling circus with different platforms that basically are connected.
Formula E is the foundation for what you're doing. And I think a key thing of that has been to advance technology so ultimately it can benefit everyone from track to road. Tell us a little bit about Formula E. For instance, you don't race on racetracks. You actually race on cities. What was the reason behind
that? Yeah, the philosophy was to take the race closer to the public and also to use the cities as really the showcase platform for these electric cars, to showcase that is the solution for mobility in the cities now. So that was the message for the cities. It's been really complicated because, of course, it's much easier to go to a racetrack and just put the cars there and race. When we go to cities, you have to build a track, shut down streets, put walls, fences, grandstands, I mean, you name it. But at the same time, it makes us very different and unique. And I think the uniqueness has been key to attract partners, manufacturers, sponsors who wanted to race in the heart of the biggest cities in the world.
You know, I don't think people fully realize this sometimes, but like you say, if it's a fixed racetrack, the stands are there, the track is there, you go into the garage, the paddock. Here, you have to actually build the racetrack, put it together in a few days, and then tear it down so that people can drive to work on Monday or Tuesday. What's the biggest problem you see, or the biggest challenge you always have in constructing a racetrack in a couple of days and then tearing it down again?
It's a huge challenge. We have a big, big team here just specialized on that. If you think about it, it's almost like a big ballet where everything needs to come together at exactly the right time. So you're putting down walls, but then you have a cable for the TV broadcasting, but then you have another cable for the timing system. Then you have the starting lights. Then you have all the flags for the marshals. Then you have the security barriers. Then you have, and everything needs to be assembled right on time. If the walls is not there, you cannot put the cable. And then you cannot put the cameras in place. And then you cannot put the barriers. And then, so everyone needs to be perfectly coordinated. And we're talking thousands of people perfectly coordinated to build this thing in a few days and then dismantle it.
Is it hard to convince the mayor of a city?
Not really. The mayors normally are very supportive of it. Of course, sometimes it's harder than others. Like there are cities where we race in places that are more, let's say, convenient. In others, like in Zurich, for example, we blocked the whole city for too long and then we didn't get the invitation to go back the next year. So we've had some of those situations. But in general, we get very well into the community. We have specific actions also with the cities in terms of installing chargers or leaving some legacy behind. So normally the mayors are happy, yeah.
It sounds like you got to get your Zurich track setup ballet to be a little bit more synchronized.
Well, I think in Zurich, the best would be to do a boat race because you do it on the lake. You are in the center of the city, but you don't need to shut down any streets.
I would imagine, too, that these mayors like to show they're doing something that's relevant to sustainability.
All the mayors in the world are really pushing the sustainability agenda. In all the big cities, you find mayors who are very receptive, independently of the political orientation, left or right or center, they are all pushing for the sustainability agenda in different degrees, but they're all pushing in the same direction.
And again, I think that same mayor would love to do something that's fun for all the people that are in their city. So once again, you get that combination of racing from the power of it, from a marketing standpoint, from an entertainment standpoint, together with sustainability.
Exactly, that's it. So for the mayor to bring entertainment to the city, to bring a big sports event that also at the same time fills the hotels, creates economic activity in the restaurants and so on, it's a winner. So mayors, they get the best of both. That's why we think it's a really attractive proposal for mayors.
The other side of making from track to road to make it relevant is to get the car manufacturer. So you've got Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Porsche, Jaguar. How did you get them interested in this? Did it just come easily? Did you have to convince them? Because that's quite a good lineup of OEMs. It wasn't that complete right away, but it grew over time.
So I think the manufacturers, what they were they were waiting to see the championship would exist and consolidate. They didn't want to get associated with the championship that was going to go bust after a few months. So when they saw after 2-3 years that the championship was strong, we had really strong backers, really strong sponsors, then is when they started to come on board. And then it's been great. And I think manufacturers have the championship as a platform to develop technology, which is very important for them. that then they can implement in their own road cars that they're going to sell to the public. So it's a great platform for the manufacturer. Happy to have them, and they really push to win. The problem sometimes having so many manufacturers is that only one can win. So the others, all the others have to go back Monday and say, we didn't win.
Now, we've had on the podcast in the past Susie Wolf, that runs the Venturi Rocket Team. And we also had Katie Munnings that raced in Extreme E. So diversity is also a key part of what you're doing. It's not just about sustainability.
Yeah, of course. I mean, getting more women into motorsport has been a priority for me for a long, long time. Since Formula 3, I had a female Formula 3 team maybe 18 years ago. And I think this format of mixed doubles is great because, you know, you have to escape from the debate of who is faster, woman or man, and create a format in which they work as a team. They're both equally decisive for victory. And I think that is the beauty of the Extreme E race format, that they work as a team. We've given a great place for really talented drivers to shine their talent, to show. As Katie is an example, all the other female drivers are great. So we're very happy with that. Yeah, it's one of the things we're most proud of.
Especially in my interview with Susie Wolf, racing is not just about driving. You have to manage a team. Like you said, the ballet is not just in setting up the track, but it's the ballet of getting a car and tuning it and taking the data and the whole business of running a racing team. Katie, like you said, you're mixed doubles in Extreme E. So you have women and men both racing equally. Each team has one of each. But Susie is actually managing a team. She's raced Formula One cars and now she's managing a team. So it shows what women can do from driving all the way through to managing a very complex operation.
Absolutely. So, I mean, Susie says it very well. Racing is not only driving the car. It's everything around. It's everything behind. It's the effort of a team. And to have women leading that, like Susie, and being having that role, I think shows also that women have a very important role to play on this sport, equally as men. And, you know, for managing a team, it's like managing a company. You know, you don't need physical strength. Drive a car, you do need physical strength. And that sometimes plays as a disadvantage for the female drivers. But to run the company, no. You just need your brain. And obviously, we know that the brain of the woman is equally, if not more, powerful than the one of the men.
When everyone thinks about electric cars, Tesla always comes to mind. Have you ever spoken to Elon? Elon, why don't you join us here? Why don't you come in and show that Tesla is the best? Have you ever engaged with him to see if he'd be willing to do this?
I did. I had a meeting with him very early on. I think it was in 2013, even maybe 2012, when we were really starting to launch the project. And I had exactly the conversation you just mentioned. I said, why don't you join Formula E with Tesla? I'm doing an electric car championship. And at the time, the answer was a very polite decline because of what he said is that, listen, I want my engineers to focus fully on delivering the road cars. I don't want them to be distracted with anything else, which is a perfectly understandable explanation. Although I've seen that he likes, for sure, fast cars. And, you know, I saw some interview of Elon talking of owning a McLaren many years ago. So he's definitely into the car. He has the car virus, if you want to call it like that.
Yeah, yeah. Like many of us, right?
But I don't think he's too keen on racing or taking his brand racing. I think putting it to compete with other brands. And Tesla is so far in its own place that me, even as a marketeer, I can understand that he wants to keep the brand without mixing them with the other brands. On the other hand, I would love to have them, of course, because it's probably the brand of electric cars. And I think it will always be. It always will be. So, yeah, it's a kind of mixed feelings, but, you know, sadly, we don't have him. But, you know, we'd love to have him in any capacity involved with us, even if he was just as a fan.
Is it time to give him another call, you think? Maybe try and get him involved, or hopefully he's listening to the Future Car podcast. Maybe this could be the invitation right here.
I know that, I mean, we have some common friends that have mentioned it over time with him, but I think the answer has always been the same. So I don't know how much success my call would have. I would just love to call him to say hello and see how he's doing. I mean, I follow him and I think he's doing very good.
Yeah, start with that. Who knows where the conversation will go. There's a couple of interesting things that are in Formula E that's different. You have this thing called the attack zone and fan boost. Tell us about those two, and especially fan boost, because that's something that brings in social media and the younger generation, and it's more than just what's happening right on the track.
Yes, you know, because Formula E or the ABB Formula Championship is new, we could take some risks or do some things differently. We wanted to involve fans. So that's fan boost. Fans can vote online on social media for the favorite driver. And that favorite driver gets a boost of energy, a short boost of energy during the race. So you basically have fans being able to interact and to have an effect on the result of the race. It's a small push, but it's certainly, you can feel it. You can do an overtaking with that. Then attack zone is a bit like the Mario Bros concept when you go across the star and you get more energy. Here you go outside the optimal racing line over a special sensor with some drawings around it and some arrows and things. And then you get 4 minutes more energy, but substantial more energy. So all the teams play their strategy of the fan boost attack mode, and it makes the races very, very interesting.
Do you think with some of your younger drivers that probably played Mario Kart, that might be a little bit of an advantage for them?
I mean, I can tell you that there is massive differences between younger drivers and older drivers on video game skill.
In what way? What's the big difference?
The older ones suck, basically. They don't know how to play video games. I don't know how to play video games against an 18-year-old. I think it's just kind of experience, or these kids have been born with a video game. I had some video games when I was young, but it was not at all the same thing. Now they're so good at video games. So you can see with the younger drivers, they're just better.
I guess probably one reason for that is you get to practice the skills that you need to drive a race car, but you can start doing it when you're 5, 6 years old. It's cheap. It's right there on your screen, and you don't have to go through all the expense of buying a go-kart.
There've been a few attempts to cross over from video game to real racing.
Does it work?
Doesn't work.
Why not?
Because driving is a very physical activity that you have to coordinate your brain with your muscles in a completely different way. So it's like a different ball game, playing a video game. Even if the chair moves and have some special effects, you will never have the G force that you get on braking aggressively on a corner at 300 kilometers an hour. That you cannot get on the video game. And that will affect the whole skill set and how you react and how your eye coordination with the muscle go and everything. So it doesn't really give you an advantage. I mean, they do a lot of sim, these drivers, to learn the tracks and the corners and the distance, but you need to be a race driver.
Yes, and I think you sort of hit it there. It might help you learn the track, like where to turn in, where the apex is, but to feel the edge of adhesion that comes through the rear end and the body and the contact with the car, no one's perfected that yet for a video game.
Not yet. Maybe in the metaverse, we will be able to do it with special, I don't know what, that envelope the whole body and it makes these G-forces and so on. But
yeah, that could be your next project.
That's part one with Alejandro. Join us on our next episode when we'll learn more about the details of the machines behind these sustainable racing series and even what to expect for the future of electric drive and racing. And as always, for more information about Siemens Digital Industries software, make sure to visit us at plm.automation.siemens.com. And until next time, I'm Ed Bernardin, and this has been the Future Car Podcast.